This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hello, welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Hello.
And with Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
We are now in award season. There are awards being handed out. We tell you all year this is award season, and for once, we mean it. The Gotham Awards took place in New York this week. The New York Film Critics Circle will be voting on their winners very soon. The ceremonies will really start flying from there. So we're going to talk about the Gotham Awards, who's ascendant, who might be even more ascendant once the critics start voting. There's events going on both coasts all over the place for movies new and old, and there are some newer titles that we're able to talk about in depth for once, like The Color Purple and Wonka, and we're going to loop back a little bit to Saltburn. So let's start with the Gothams. Richard, you were there in person. I think you had a pretty great seat. You were sitting with some of the cast of The Gilded Age, which, like, you know, the most important show of the moment as far as I'm concerned. You've been to the Gothams a lot. What was it like this year?
It was lively. I mean, I think that it was probably the starriest Gothams I've been to. Maybe that was just a product of who won, you know, either nominated awards or tribute awards that I don't know how those are determined. but it was everyone from Leo to Greta to Julianne to Natalie to, you know, it was just like
all those people you're on first name basis with because they're so famous.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Of course, I meant Greta Van Susteren, Natalie Morales. you know,
I would pay to see her.
Leo Tipton. I was at the Vanity Fair table, which was pretty centrally located because VF is sort of the media sponsor for these awards. So I had a good, you know, view of everything. And it was interesting. I mean, the Gothams, you know, do non-gendered acting categories. So you really only get two acting speeches unless, as it happened the first year they did this, they were just were suddenly ties in both lead and supporting. But no, this year it was just two. But I think that my biggest takeaway from the evening was Lily Gladstone won for best lead actor, not for Killers of the Flower Moon, for her other movie. And it did kind of feel like it was secretly a Flower Moon win. They just couldn't say that because I think that those nominated categories are... Well, no, because Gosling was nominated. I don't really know how the budget casting
works. They didn't
works.
Submit it. They didn't submit
They didn't the submit it. Okay, thank you. Thank
right.
you, David.
Thank yeah, you for so, the reminder.
Yes, they didn't submit Flower Moon. But anyway, she won for The Unknown Country. And her speech was very, like, rousingly received. And people leapt to their feet. And I just feel like I saw a preview of an Oscar speech in her. That was my big takeaway, is that Lily Gladstone is very much a front runner in Best Actress.
Mm-hmm. It seemed that way from afar as well. And last year, I remember when Ki Huy Quan won for Everything Everywhere All at Once, we had said similar things on this podcast, and that bore out pretty well. And she does seem to be occupying a similar kind of space in the conversation. It is a little strange that she won for a different movie, especially given that because these categories are combined, that race was really stacked with a lot of really strong performers. But yeah, last year, as I was reminded, my great hope, Daniel Deadweiler, won that award. But she wasn't present at the ceremony. She did get to present this year. And I think it does make an impact as the first show when you are there, you give a great speech. She also gave a great speech for the Killers Tribute Award. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a big night for her, and also for Charles Melton, which we can talk about.
So these winners are voted on by juries. I'm looking at the nominations announcement. Those nominees are made by juries. They kind of share who's on those lists and don't share specifically who votes on the winners. But we're assuming it's a pretty small group of people who are determining Lily Gladstone and the other winners in the category. So should we just kind of explain why we feel like this is a harbinger of what might happen at the Oscars, even though it's a completely different group of people?
I mean, with Gladstone, I just feel like there is obviously the matter that no Native American person has ever won an Oscar, or I think, and if there are nominees, it's very few. So I think there's that aspect. There's the fact that she's really good in the movie. And there's the fact that I think that if Flower Moon is going to win anything, maybe that's their best chance at this point. And it's an interesting way to not push back against, but respond to the various controversies surrounding how Killers of the Flower Moon is framed, you know, despite working with members of the Osage Nation pretty extensively in the making of the film. A lot of Native people, activists, critics, etc., have kind of come out against the movie, I think, in recent weeks. And so if you say, okay, we hear you, but what about Lily Gladstone? She's really good, right? And we all, you know, can coalesce around that aspect of the film. I just think that's a very, like, you know, that's an interesting way to give that movie a big award while also still kind of tacitly or not acknowledging that the rest of the film has some issues in the eyes of a lot of people.
The strongest public critique of the movie came from Devery Jacobs, the star of Reservation Dogs, in a tweet thread. And even in one of the tweets, she said, give Lily Gladstone the Oscar. So I think, to your point, Richard, that is definitely where you can meet in the middle a little bit here on pretty varying perspectives.
Yeah, and I don't mean that to minimize her work. I mean, it's genuinely a great performance, and she stands toe-to-toe with other potential nominees. It just kind of helps, I guess, that, like, not only would she be a front runner anyway, but there's also this other issue surrounding the film that I think is giving that film a lot more attention maybe than it would otherwise have gotten.
It's amazing how I feel like I've just forgotten that she won for a different movie.
Exactly.
It just really feels like a like the first prize for Killers of the Flower Moon. But yeah, I think it's also similar with Charles Melton. It's like these two winners, even though the voters are not representative of the Academy, they're winning the first award really of the season. They're taking the stage, they're giving the speech, and it helps sort of elevate them from the very crowded fields they're in. And I think for both of them, it's huge. You know, if it had been like Ryan Gosling or something, it wouldn't feel as much of a like a big win. But for them to get this attention, you know, at this early point in the season, I think is really, really helpful to their campaigns.
Yeah. I want to talk about Charles Melton in a moment. He was on our podcast just last week. But watching Lily Gladstone, there was a clip from the set of Killers of the Flower Moon that went around last week. I don't remember if Apple posted it, but it was of the day that she rapped on set. And it's her kind of standing there and speaking to the cast and crew about how grateful she was to make the movie. And Leonardo DiCaprio is standing right there next to her. They're standing in a field in one of their scenes together. And he's just kind of like gazing at her and like shining all of his star power light on her. And then at the Gothams, he was there as well. And there's a video that we post on our Instagram of them on the red carpet together. And he's doing the exact same thing. He's like there as a giant movie star, but basically saying with all of his body language, look at her instead. And I think that's incredibly powerful. And I just feel like that's a power of her campaign that's really coming into focus now that they're both able to be back out there together.
I thought about that with Charles Melton, too, because he's at the show as the only acting nominee from the movie. Its only other nominee was for screenplay. But at that table, you had Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman and Todd Haynes, who were absolutely ecstatic and very clearly there for him when he won. And that's really powerful because in his case, the timing could not have been more perfect. I mean, on my end, and yes, I have a particular silo, the buzz around the movie and people talking to me about the movie is pretty deafening right now. It is hitting Netflix this week. And he is someone who everybody comes out of that movie and is like, holy shit, Charles Melton. I mean, truly, there are tweets that say, holy shit, Charles Melton. But I think that there's a corner of the industry, a pretty big corner of the industry, who is like, who, or particularly in the Academy adjacent side of the industry? Like, who are we talking about here in a movie with Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman? And seeing them all sort of crowd around him, and truly, I mean, the excitement for him was very palpable among those actors. It sends a signal that he is somebody to really consider in this race and to pay attention to. And it is because of that support group, I think, that you see around him.
Yeah, when he won, we were right next to the May-December table, and Julianne in particular, like, leapt to her feet and, like, let out a yip and, like, gave him a huge hug and was, like, beaming throughout his speech. And, like, I think that, you know, last year at the Gothams, Kiwi Kwan won supporting actor. And, you know, he has a very different narrative than Charles Melton does, certainly. But I'm just wondering a little bit if awards-giving bodies, including the Academy, have maybe become a little addicted in just a short time to, like, that sort of surprising underdog narrative, you know, with big star backing. I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis ultimately did get an Oscar for her Troubles, but, like, she was largely responsible, I think, her lending her star power, shining her star power toward other people for a lot of Everything Everywhere's wins.
That was the whole phase one campaign on her, and it was for the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I hope they paid her, you know, handsomely for that.
She's paid in googly eyes.
Yeah. She and Frances Fisher are meeting in some underground bunker this year to decide where to throw their weight. But yeah, I think that the Melton's story is interesting. I think that movie, as compared to Everything Everywhere, which was a big sort of populist hit, May December is going to have a tougher time ingratiating itself to people. But the Melton narrative, despite that, is still pretty potent. And this was, like you said, Katie, like very well, or maybe David said it, sorry, very well timed. To push that movie firmly now into the awards conversation. Because as of like a week ago, I was like, I don't know if that's going to get any nominations. And now it feels like, no, it's definitely in that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, the Todd Haynes track record makes you have reason to be skeptical. Yeah. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He really, you say underdog, and I think he comes in with that because people are like, Riverdale, that guy, you know, and like, even when before we saw it in Cannes, I think it was like, oh, this is sort of random. And then you see this performance, and because your expectations maybe are a little lower, he really, really exceeds them. And he's so incredibly talented opposite these two really talented actresses that I think that helps him, and he's been doing some really great interviews, including with David, and I think he's really shaping up to be a really strong campaign.
It is fast. So I don't think Charles Melton's character in May December is a Ken exactly, but I do think he is in conversation with Ken and with Mark Ruffalo's character in Poor Things, these three strong supporting actor contenders whose characters exist entirely in relation to the women that the movies are actually about. That's got to be incredibly rare in that category. And of course, Robert Downey Jr., that's not his character at all, and he's probably going to win anyway, but that's an interesting trend to keep an eye on.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it also helps that, I rewatched May December over the Thanksgiving break. And man, is that movie good. Yeah. Better than I even remembered from seeing it in May. And he just, his character and that performance, like, it provides the crucial, like, emotional grounding that you're kind of, that I think certain viewers are searching for in that movie, which is otherwise kind of coy and elusive and strange and, like, you know, shifty. And the two lead, you know, actors are playing characters who are kind of inscrutable in some ways. Mm-hmm. And then Melton shows up and has a couple really big scenes where that's when it's just very accessible all of a sudden, that movie's sort of core emotion. And that, you know, that goes a long way, I think, in addition to the narrative of the Riverdale guy.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as The Regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs.
So elsewhere at the Gothams, I feel like we should say that Anatomy of a Fall won 2 awards. It won Best International Feature and Best Screenplay. And I said earlier I didn't know who the juries were for the winners. In the press release, it says who the juries were. So just sorry, Gothams. It's very clear. And that does feel pretty significant, though. That's 2 different groups of juries that picked it for these 2 pretty big awards. What was that crew like at the awards, Richard?
I mean, visible for sure. You know, I think that, again, that movie, the nation of France took a gamble in putting up the Taste of Things for international feature with the Oscars. I think the thinking was Anatomy is going to do well in other categories, so we can kind of double our odds. And I think that the Gotham certainly confirmed that. There was a lot of energy in the room for that movie when it won its awards. And, you know, I think that there was maybe a risk. We were talking for weeks about how that movie had this advantage because it could, you know, the actors could promote it and they could do Q&As and all that stuff. But I think there was also a risk of people getting a little fatigued and really ready for the other stuff that were banned, you know, from promotion by the strikes. Now all attention has turned to them. So I think that it's good that Anatomy reasserted itself and said, we're still here, we're still part of this. And yeah, I do predict a lot of, you know, big things to come for that movie.
The international feature race was, it's a pretty notable win just because it had movies like Poor Things and All of Us Strangers in addition to mm-hmm. that in the Zone of Interest. So it was a really competitive category. And a couple of years ago, when The Lost Daughter won a lot of different categories at the Gothams, it kind of similarly signaled that it could be a player in a few different races. So it's always a good sign, even if it is small juries and doesn't say that much. It does say something.
I do want to say one more thing about the Gothams before we move on, that A Small Light, the show that I talked about and then didn't go anywhere at the Emmys, won a Gotham Award.
We did it,
for
Katie.
Breakthrough Series. I know. It's so good.
I thought of you and I saw
it. I want people to watch it finally. But also Beef won 2 awards as well on television, which doesn't come as a big surprise. It's still going to go win some Emmys, I guess.
It hasn't been able to win anything yet. I mean, this is the first time.
I literally was sitting there for a second being like, yeah, it's this Emmys, right? It got nominated. I'll get my head around that at some point.
I don't think Past Lives winning Best Feature was a surprise among its competition, but it does feel like a good moment for the film, you know, because we've talked about how they have this sort of long road after being a Sundance premiere, and that's not always the easiest. And I think it does help its momentum as it continues. I don't know how you guys feel, but I feel like it's a good boost for it.
It's a reminder that it hasn't been forgotten, which I think is the big, the only question mark with that movie is, did it fade away? And I think the answer is no.
Yeah. It's kind of similar to Anatomy of a Fall, right? Where it had the whole lane to itself, but now it's reasserting itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we'll have the New York Film Critics Circle. Those awards will be announced as they're voted on Thursday. So the day that people are listening to this, if they are doing their due diligence and listening right when this podcast gets posted, which I hope you all are, you know, and I think that Anatomy and Past Lives are likely to be represented in that, you know, in those awards in some capacity. Maybe I'm wrong, but just taking the temperature of my fellow members at the Gothams and at screenings and stuff like that, Past Lives is certainly not forgotten in that contingent at all.
Yeah, that leads me well into what I wanted to talk about next. I mean, Richard, you can't reveal in advance the results of a vote that hasn't happened yet, or, you know, maybe not tip your hand too much, but you will be voting with the New York Film Critics Circle. Different critics groups vote in different ways, you guys, and I think the Los Angeles critics kind of get together in a room and, you know, maybe do less yelling back and forth than we like to imagine. The LAFCA vote will be on December 10th. Critics' Choice is on December 13th. That's all just emailed ballots, kind of a, you know, rough tally wins. But do you kind of have a sense, Richard, with you voting or anybody, of what other titles might be primed to get a really big bump as these critics' awards start coming in the next few weeks?
Well, I mean, the New York critics, as evidenced by wins for The Irishman, like they're big on Scorsese, you know, so I expect to see that movie well represented during the vote, which is all done silently. You just write things on little pieces of paper and then the votes are read out loud, but not your name is not attached to them. So it is kind of anonymous.
You make it sound like you'd be like a bunch of monks picking a new pope or something.
Yeah, well, yeah, then white smoke comes out of the top of Lincoln Center and, you know.
Only if Charles Melton's name is read aloud.
Right, exactly. So I think the Scorsese, I think, you know, I'll be curious to see how the movies that screened kind of late do, like The Iron Claw and Color Purple. And a couple other titles that, like, I haven't had the opportunity to talk to fellow members about how they, you know, what they thought of those movies. So I'm curious about that. But, you know, I think we won't, I mean, I won't really have any genuine sense of how things are going until we're doing it, because I have stormed in there in the past and been like, well, it's a sure thing. Carrie Coon's winning for the Nest because I talked to three members who also were voting for her. And then it was like, we were the three votes for Carrie Coon, you know, like no, I'm sure there were more. I don't remember, but I'm just using that as a vague example. But like, you know, I think that I have my ideas, but the group is pretty large at this point, and it's also pretty varied in terms of age and experience and, you know, approach to both the awards and to just film in general. So I'm kind of unable each year to take an accurate temperature. So I will be finding out along with everyone else where the group sits on Thursday.
I'm really curious to see Best Actress specifically. New York obviously kicks off a bunch of critics awards from various places. And last year, Cate Blanchett kind of ran the table along those lines, and that wasn't a huge surprise. Not to say there weren't a lot of great performances, but it was just sort of an obvious frontrunner for Critics Awards. But this year, it feels like there are a lot of really, really strong candidates. We're talking about Lily Gladstone and Sandra Hüller. There's, of course, Emma Stone, who I feel like is going to pick up a few. Carey Mulligan, I'm sure, will get a lot of support. And given how strong that category is this year, it could make an impact. Even as we saw last year, somebody like Michelle Yeoh on the campaign trail can also be powerful.
I'm personally curious about how Poor Things is going to fare with the New York critics and then all later on with the larger groups.
Yeah.
Because it's a weird and arty movie from Yorgos Lanthimos, who is a director a lot of critics really love, but it's also kind of like a fable. Like, it's a very simple story. Like, there's a it's not that it's not thematically rich, but it's like less thorny than, say, May, December. And I really wonder how that will land as critics kind of, you know, want to single it out, or if it will just kind of fall more in the middle than we might have expected a month ago.
I have an intuition that, like, that movie is really well liked, but I think Stone being kind of the leader of that pack. I mean, I think Ruffalo and even Defoe are going to get, you know, lots of attention too, but like, I think that one thing hindering it is people are like, she just won, you know, she mm-hmm. just had her whole run. And it was like, that was 7 years ago. You know, it wasn't like that recently. But I think in the mind, it's like there's more excitement coalescing around first time nominees or first time winners. And so while Emma Stone is giving one of the performances of the year, as I wrote about in our best performances list that people can read, I think, on the site now, you know, she's incredible in it, and will certainly get lots of love and attention for it. I would assume an Oscar nomination is in the offing. But in terms of winning things, I think that she might just kind of read a little too, like, her last win was just too recent.
A few films that I love that I'm not sure about for different reasons as Oscar contenders that are kind of in that upper critical tier are Zone of Interest and All of Us Strangers. So those are two that I'm watching to see if they can pick up any momentum.
It feels like Zone of Interest has to do something with the critics groups to, like,
yeah,
continue on at all. So I agree. I think that's sort of a deal breaker if it doesn't in the next couple weeks.
But that's also when I feel like you could be like, oh, best picture from New York Film Critics Circle, Zone of Interest.
Yep.
Like,
no, that's
totally
exactly
possible.
Exactly. It could go in either direction.
Yeah, or like Sandra Hüller wins supporting actress for that and doesn't win best actress for Anatomy of a Fall. Like, it could really go in a lot of different directions.
Yeah. At the Oscars, I could see Zone of Interest getting best picture nomination and best director, and that's it. Like, mm-hmm. I think that's a very possible outcome.
I could even just see best director.
Yeah.
Which never happens, but could.
I should also say, for people watching their awards calendar, the National Board of Review nominations are December 6th. So that's kind of coming in between the major critics groups, and we'll talk about that next week. Well, Richard, you were talking about how the Barbie crew was at the Gotham Awards, largely thanks to these tribute awards, which are a little puzzling, but I think up to the star power, as we discussed. And then they had a big event in New York also the day after the Gothams. They're not the only ones kind of hustling all over town this week, right?
No. I've gotten so many invites to old school Peggy Siegel-esque luncheons for movies. I have not had an invite like that in years, not just because of the pandemic. like there's an Oppenheimer luncheon and at Lincoln Center and something, you know, other things happening. And it really feels like they had to take a couple weeks to get all the scheduling figured out. And now it is fully off to the races. I was talking to an awards publicist from Netflix at the Gothams, and he seemed exhausted because he's like, yeah, it's just everything had to happen like the last 2 days. And now here we are. And there, luckily, these events like the Gothams or things in LA where all the talent is going to be in town anyway. So why don't we just, you know, schedule 18 different lunches?
Yeah. What's it like in LA? Is it chaos?
Same thing. Yeah. Same thing.
A lot of evening events, like All of Us Strangers is having an event like in my neighborhood in East LA. And I'm like, this is weird. Like it's all over town.
Get out of
it's,
my town.
I know. This is my non-awards neighborhood. Get out of here. But yeah, Barbie's having a big event, I think. I mean, there's just been a ton of events in the next, I think before the holidays, they're just cramming them in as much as possible.
Yeah. Whole casts coming through because mm-hmm. it was strange. All of Us Strangers, that's obviously going to be a big deal for that movie. And they're all in town next weekend. This weekend, you'll have Margot, Greta, Ryan Gosling, and America Ferrera are taking part in a big Barbie reception. And yeah, it's everything and everywhere right now. It's just crazy.
Well, because it feels early because Thanksgiving just happened. But if you look at the calendar, like you've got next week, the week of December 4th, the week of December 11th, then the week after that, like my kids' school is done for Christmas halfway through that week. Like you've really only got 2 more weeks after this to really pound the pavement. Because then once you get back, it's all the award shows and the time is really nigh.
You know what a lot of strategists have been bringing up to me as suddenly very important are Golden Globe nominations, which is maybe not surprising, but I keep hearing about that, you know, more than guilds even. It's just like suddenly there is a real investment in getting people out there to get them on a national TV show in a month. So it's also just the fact that the strike ended when it did and the Golden Globes suddenly regained this prominence because they're going to be airing on CBS, you know, regardless of what you think about the merit of the awards or not, that does matter a great deal. And so that's a big reason, I think, for the compressed nature of this as well, is a lot of these big nominations are coming up quickly and that determines who goes in those rooms, who is talking to each other, and who is kind of staying in the conversation. Because for a lot of these movies, they are in a gray area still, and that gets clarified rather quickly.
I say this with great compassion for both publicists and talent who have to promote, but it is kind of fun watching them sweat because no one's a front runner right now. And they're all just like clawing, scrambling. Like, it's like kind of great. Like, you know, usually by this time, like there is some sense of like, okay, those people are in first, second position. And then 3, 4, 5, they're just kind of, you know, everyone's fighting that out. But like this year, I don't feel that way at all about really any category beyond like maybe Downey Jr. and supporting, you know? It's kind of fun that because there's so much uncertainty that everyone is really like doing their most to be seen. And I don't know, maybe we should kind of compress this timeline every year because I know it's exhausting for people, but like it's fun to watch.
Well, isn't that kind of what we talked about when the strike ended? Like it really felt like things were finally properly kicking off in November, and perhaps that would be a more sane way to operate. I don't know what we'd do with ourselves for 3 months, but we could probably figure it out.
Yeah. Also, no one can pretend that they don't care. No time for that. You know,
right, exactly. Yeah.
And it's nice to see that. It's nice for everyone to kind of be on the same level in terms of participating.
Yeah, no one's striking any cool, like, oh, awards? Huh, I didn't even realize it was that season. No one is doing
that. I'll do one cover in September.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone's just hitting the ground. And they can, you know, and look, they're just supporting the film. They're not advocating for themselves, of course.
Of course, but, like, not.
Yeah, there's a hunger in the air. I like it.
Well, David, in your interview with Annette Bening that ran this week, you kind of asked her point blank, like how she feels about the thought of winning an Oscar, which I love. I don't think I could do it. I think I would chicken out answering that question. And she had what like probably isn't the full honest answer. You know, I don't know if anyone's ever fully honest about how much they want to win an award. But I thought she was very nicely frank about being like, yeah, of course, I've thought about it. Like I've been nominated a bunch of times. I was impressed by her.
Yes, that moment only came about because it had been a nice conversation. And I felt comfortable asking it, but I did appreciate her answer, and there was a smile that kind of crept through, just at the thought of it. Yeah, people care. And Annette Bening is someone we've talked about on this podcast who has been close a number of times, may be close again, and I would imagine it's a memory of feeling like you're right there, and then it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
I also think in this era of unceremonious, like, oh, now that movie's on Netflix and now it's on streaming, you know, whatever, like, that kind of awards tension actually will bring eyes to the movie itself, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that people are really keenly aware of that, because things feel like they get lost, you know, with like limited releases in a couple major cities across the country, and then otherwise it's on streaming with not much fanfare. And Naiad is one of those movies, I think. Even if, like, putting aside like a personal wish for, like, you know, that kind of recognition, there's got to be an awareness that, like, that's a really good way to advertise the movie. And that's really crucial now, when, especially when, like, marketing budgets are not what they used to be.
Yeah, I think there is, absolutely.
Well, another cast that's been all over the place, and it's for a newer movie, is The Color Purple, which we talked about a little bit last week, where kind of some of the social sentiment was starting to come out and Danielle Brooks was really emerging as a real standout. But I do feel like the momentum behind it keeps growing, particularly as the Christmas window arrives and it feels like it could really make a lot of money. And Richard, you've been able to see it. Do you kind of get the same sense that the tide is rising there?
Yeah, it feels, I mean, eventful in certain crucial ways. I think Danielle Brooks is definitely leading that charge. I mean, you know, she has that the big, like, Hell No song, which is like kind of the most rousing musical number in the first half third of the movie. It's a fun character. I mean, obviously sad things eventually do happen to that character, but, like, it's just a big, loud, sort of vibrant role and also performance that Danielle Brooks has already honed on stage. And yeah, I think there's enough artistry and like careful intent in the movie to make it stand out. It does not feel like some sort of also ran at all. I think obviously that movie is being theatrically released and does have, I think, some box office potential. And if it's a hit, I think that pushes it way ahead of a lot of other movies that are currently sort of better positioned. But I think that positioning is pretty tenuous. If Color Purple connects with audiences, I think it's really off to the races for that movie.
I do feel like it's going to be a hit, but how many times have we thought a musical is going to be a hit and then been very severely burned by our prediction? So I'm worried about that. But, you know, I did a screening in L.A. I was talking to our colleague Chris Murphy, who moderated one in New York. And the crowds are just, like, really, really energetic about this. And almost, you know, there's people dressing up in purple. And, like, you see a lot of energy for it. So, yeah, I do think it's going to be a hit. And I agree, Richard, it'll really, really help its chances.
To the Danielle Brooks point, you know, even though West Side Story didn't hit with box office, there's a similar character arc between Anita and West Side Story and Sophia here, because it's a fun character, it's a big character, and then it gets to be a deeper, richer performance in the film's last act. And it feels like it could be a similar sort of sweep for her, honestly, if the movie connects at that level, because it's got all of those ingredients. The character is so well-known and iconic, and it just kind of feels like everything's falling into place there, maybe, a little bit.
Yeah, and she has such an amazing connection to that character, having played it on mm-hmm. stage as well. I mean, she talks about it being the first show she ever saw on Broadway. Like, she really has the narrative that goes along with that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think Danielle Brooks is a little bit better known on screen than Ariana DeBose was before West Side Story. But, you know, just both of them as, like, Broadway veterans kind of taking a big leap into film, like, the narratives track very nicely.
Yep.
I think we can't underestimate the fact that Danielle Brooks was pretty ubiquitous in a lot of homes for a number of years on Orange is the New Black, mm-hmm. you know?
Like, and so good.
And so good on it, and such an interesting, ultimately kind of tragic character. And a great one of the standout performances on that very, very popular show. And I think that goes a long way toward your more casual Academy voter being like, oh, right, her, Tasty from Orange is the New Black. She's great. You know, let me vote for her.
I've been wondering about Fantasia Barrino as I think about this movie being ascendant and look at the Best Actress race and how insanely crowded it is. But it does, you know, as we talk about this, it seems very possible she could come in and bump out one of the names that we've been talking about for so many months.
They need to figure out a way for her to perform I'm Here at some sort of pre-nominations thing. Yeah. Like, I don't know what that would be, but, like, just to get people to remember how powerful that moment is in the movie as it was on stage, and how it feels like that song was written for her, you know, that would be big for her. Because she is good, but, you know, because of the nature of the character, it's a little more recessive. You know, it's not as, like, showy and out there until it is at the very end. But she's really good, you know, and she's been doing this role in various forms for a long time. So I hope that she doesn't get lost in the shuffle.
It feels like a matter of just how that category is going to shake out. There are truly so many possibilities. And she's definitely one of them, but she's not a slam dunk for the reasons Richard just mentioned. One thing I really like about her performance is, even given the nature of the character, it's a really subtle, almost really intricate approach to her that I found really moving, but it is not huge. It is not take up the screen the way Danielle Brooks or Taraji P. Henson does. And that can be an issue in a category where there are a lot of performances that do that this year.
Richard, do you remember in the Les Mis campaign when they did a luncheon and Hugh Jackman and Anne Hathaway like sang, stood up in the middle of the room and sang songs from Les Mis? This happened.
I planned that, organized it.
It's your greatest
paid
triumph.
For them to sing with my own money. Yeah, I think that kind of thing, you know, they just need to get the Color Purple people out on the road, you know, and I don't know what Barino's level of like, I was watching something they did, I think at the Academy in LA, like a post screening Q&A, and she said that she really had to be coaxed several times to even agree to do the mm-hmm. movie. So I don't know what that was. I don't know what her hesitancy was. I mean, maybe it was just like, I did it so long ago, I don't really want to revisit that, which I totally understand. It's tough material. But I just wonder what her level of interest in campaigning is. But if they get that cast out and they're singing at things and they're, you know, shaking hands, kissing babies, all that, I think that charm offensive, because the people in the cast have a lot of charm, including Coleman Domingo, I think that would be kind of an unstoppable force in some ways.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
People want coverage of Donald Trump. There are sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Well, speaking of musicals and what we get our hopes up for, Wonka is another musical that's right on the horizon. I think mm-hmm. There are social reactions out there. The review embargo hasn't lifted. We don't want to like over discuss it, but I've been shamelessly hyping Wonka for months. I'm not going to apologize for that. But, you know, now that I've actually seen it, I can maybe be more realistic. But yeah, when that screener came out for critics consideration, it was an event amongst us over Thanksgiving weekend. But I had such a great time with it, and I'm so excited about it. I feel like it's tailor made to get a bazillion Golden Globe nominations, which will come out a couple days before it actually opens in theaters. But, you know, Richard, you were not on the Wonka hype train to the extent that I was, and you also liked it, so back me up here.
I stand firmly corrected. Yeah. I just hadn't, I knew it intellectually that, oh, it's the Paddington 2 guy. Like, you know, I knew that there was that connection, but I didn't, I think maybe it was just the trailer wasn't great, but
the trailer had no songs in it, which is, you know, a mistake.
And the songs are lovely. I mean, they're very simple, but like I got teary at one of them and I actually cried 3 times in the movie while watching the movie. It's good. I think Chalamet's great. I was saying to someone who also had seen it, kind of like Anne Hathaway, speaking of Les Mis, like sometimes you just have to let the theater kid lead. You have to let it out. You know, you can do the dark, gritty, minimalist acting. That's great. All well and good. Do Dune, do, you know, Beautiful Boy, whatever. But Timothy Chalamet is a theater kid, and Wonka lets him be that in very charming fashion, and it's fun to watch him sort of unloosed like that.
I went in with extremely low expectations after that trailer, and it opens with this scene of him like standing on a boat, And I was like, nope. And then literally five seconds later, he starts singing and it moves to another location. And I was like, oh, yes, this is wonderful. Like, it wins you over so fast in that first number that I was like, I see what I you're right. You just have to embrace where we're going with this. And it's very, very charming. I'm not quite as hot on it as you two. I think people should still go in with reasonable expectations. But it is very, it's just a really enjoyable watch.
Yeah, I thought Timothée Chalamet acquitted himself so well and has his like lanky body doing all those dance moves just has such a specific power. But also the supporting cast, who is some names that you recognize, Sally Hawkins is in there, Olivia Colman is in there, but also people who like, I think if you watch a lot of British TV, you know, but I did not, who are just like killing it in scene after scene. There's so many like funny, specific people who like a lot of them get their own little subplots, which are very charming. It feels very rich and like well lived in, which I think the Paddington movies had a lot of going for them as well. It really added to the experience for me.
I think that one thing that's very hard to do in adapting Roald Dahl, I mean, this is not literally an adaptation of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. It's pretty
light in its IP, I think. You don't have to like pay attention to details there.
But it does capture this sort of like shaggy, kind of weird, slightly dark, menacing quality of the best Roald Dahl stuff, you know, in a way that the Zemeckis witches certainly did not. And just this movie, like, it's very much a movie for children, which is all well and good. But it has these little pricklier dimensions that I think distinguish it from a lot of comparable stuff from, let's say, other studios that run the world. I'm saying Disney. It does not feel like a Disney movie in a way that I found really appealing. So,
well, it's been overhyped for me, so.
Well, sorry, David. We can't sit, hide our light under a bushel. We have to share our enthusiasm for Wonka.
No, you do. Even though I will now look out for Timothée Chalamet on a boat, to Rebecca's warning.
It's like literally the opening shot of the movie.
It is. And I was like, I'm not on board. And then I was like, oh, I am on board. So you'll change quickly.
Well, there might be time to talk about it later on once David has gotten a look at it. But, you know, I think I talked about this last week. The Christmas box office is stressing me out. I really hope people don't just like end the year on a bummer note, but if Wonka and the Color Purple can both make money and prove that people like musicals, I will be so thrilled. That does it for today's show. We'll be back next week. Find us at Vanity Fair, on social media at VF Awards Insider. I am on social media at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylaws.
And David.
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the thing that Bart Freundlich heard all the time while his wife Julianne Moore was on the set of May December goes to David Canfield.
Holy shit, Charles Melton.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.